Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Design Dialogues podcast. And this week I am so proud and pleased to bring to you our live recording from the event we held in the Sydney Sitara showroom a few weeks ago. It is a panel with Lynn Bradley, Sally Rees-Jones and Gemma Gillett, and we talk about all things design business. It's a great chat and I really hope you enjoy it. I also have a really special announcement that we are going to be doing another live event. And this time, Brisbane, it is your turn. On November 28th, in the Brisbane Sitara showroom, we will be having a live panel discussion and we will be announcing the panelists in the coming days. So make sure you watch out on socials and watch out for our newsletters as well, where we will be announcing the panelists for our Brisbane live event on November 28th. So we will be releasing ticket sales for that soon. So I hope everyone up in Brisbane can join us because it was such a fun evening here in Sydney and I'm sure it's going to be equally as fun up in Brisbane. So please, I hope you enjoy today's episode. And as always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out. Hi, I'm Beth Bieske, the founder of More Time to Design and your host of the Design Dialogues podcast. I've been a designer for the last 12 years and I've run my own studio for 5. And I know how hard it is to run a successful business. You not only need to be great at designing, but you need to be great at all the other things as well. I created More Time to Design, a software platform to help designers run efficient studios, and I've created the Design Dialogue podcast to help us all learn together. Each week, we will meet professionals who are at the top of their game doing things that help us run our studios. We'll have conversations with social media managers, interior design mentors, copywriters, stylists, photographers, suppliers, and also designers who have been in the game for a long time and who have such a wealth of knowledge to share. I hope that each week you feel inspired and informed at the end of each of our design dialogues. So join me for the Design Dialogue podcast.
For those of you who don't know me, my name's Beth Bieske. I am an interior designer and the founder of More Time to Design, which is a cloud-based studio and project management platform for interior designers. I started the platform because my experience as a studio owner and also general manager for one of Australia's leading interior designers, I clearly knew there had to be a better way for us to run our studios. So that's how More Time to Design started. The other part of the More Time to Design story is, of course, the Design Dialogues podcast. I am a naturally curious person and I love to hear how other designers have built their businesses. I've had the pleasure of interviewing our 3 panel event members already on the podcast and I'm very excited to get to find out a little bit more about their businesses tonight. So please welcome our panel this evening. We have Sally Rees-Jones, Lynn Bradley and Gemma Gillett from Studio Gemma. Okay, so for regular listeners of the podcast, you're going to know that my first question is always, what can you see out your window today? That doesn't quite work here tonight. So I would love to know, what is the view from one of your current projects? Sally.
Are our mics working?
We have a really nice view of Manly Wharf out one of our windows. And I'm sure some of you will find this funny. We have the view of a building site next door, which our client likes to say, I hope my house looks better than that, every time we're on site, which is not very helpful.
Sorry, I get a bit nervous with my New Zealand accent. What do I have? I also have a massive house, which everyone in the street hates because we are 5 years into construction. And in that time, there has been multiple neighbours move in who are not happy, but coastal views probably similar.
I also have coastal views. I have a project that I'm just wrapping up in Mosman, and my view from the balcony is of Balmoral Beach, which is very expensive because I keep going down to bathers for lunch, which is a disaster.
Okay, so I'm seeing a trend. We've all got some beachside projects at the moment, very full. So we have the privilege of often working on our clients' largest asset and helping them with projects that they have put a lot of time, a lot of thought, and a lot of money into. And with that can come some really high emotions, good and bad. I'd love to know, how do you guys balance the needs of your clients and then the needs of you as the business owner? Because when it all kind of those emotions come to the front, how do you put in balance and guidelines and boundaries with your client? Sally, just because you're the closest.
I know, I'm first all the time now. Well, I think the first thing is that, I mean, we all know our clients get really stressed, but having renovated myself recently, I think it's important to actually acknowledge the stress and that it's legitimately okay to be stressed. Because it is stressful, or on the flip side, if they're stressing about something that's not worth stressing about, be like, it's no problem. And someone told me last year that people will mirror your emotions. I had a particularly stressed client last year and I tried that out on her. So I think if you stay really calm, a bit like looking at a hostie on a plane when there's turbulence. I think if you stay really calm, they're going to be like, oh, well, you're not worried, so I'm not going to be worried. And that actually did work quite well, even though I was actually quite stressed. I mean, like, stay calm, stay calm. And then the other one is setting boundaries at the start. I'm not very good at verbally telling people you can't call me or email me, but I just act how I want to act for the rest of the job. So I will only reply to emails during business hours. I will only reply to phone calls during business hours. We have a client at the moment who likes to send us, you know, 15 to 20 emails a day. And I'll only reply to the ones that really need to be replied to. So I think if you act how you intend to act for the rest of the project right at the start, they'll kind of get a picture of like what's acceptable and what's not. Yeah.
Just visually seeing that many emails from that client, like I can feel the stress rising. Do you try and educate the client in a way to say, you know what, this isn't working, can we capture those thoughts in another way?
Sometimes. This client is all right and he knows he's doing it and he makes jokes about it. But I have had other clients that have done that and we've said, look, it's not really good use of your time or our time to be like putting every thought you have into an email. So why don't you just like have a good think about it, think about it for the week, think about it overnight, and then, you know, once a, you know, a week or once a month we can update your drawings, but not, you know, every day. But it depends on the person.
And so much of it is what we do is that emotional intelligence of reading the client, because one client will react really well when you point out this is not helpful, and another client's going to...
Yeah, you've got to be careful.
Gemma, what do you do?
Same as Sally. So if they are really highly strung, I will try and meet them where they're at the first time and remind them that it's going to be okay. If they like to start a WhatsApp group, that's probably my worst. I don't like the WhatsApp group. I'll turn my read receipts off because I'm like, oh God, what now? What else do? I, with clients that like to email me back and forth, I will schedule all my emails and I'll send them at like 5:37 p.m. They'll just go boom, 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 boom. I'm like, we're not going ping pong. I'm not doing this with you for hours. What else do I do? I would say, up front I try and like, if someone's giving me red flag energy, I'll try and dodge that client from the get-go. But also sometimes smoke and mirrors, sometimes people make you believe that they're nice and they're not, and then you're too far in.
Yeah,
They're very good at camouflaging those red flags.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, I think we all agree that it's setting boundaries right from the very beginning. So I have my boundaries listed in my contract fee proposal, very clearly stated, and I always take the time to read through every bullet point with my client when they're signing so that they understand. And I'm very nice about it, and I don't make it sound like I'm a schoolmistress, I hope. But I do try and make it very clear. And, of course, you can't control everything. But one of the things that certainly helps me is having a scheduled site meeting with the client. That's a really good thing. The other thing is silence. Silence is key. So the bombardment of emails or text messages or DMs, which they're not supposed to send me, I just sit on it for a little bit. I don't have time to be reactive all the time. It doesn't work for them. Mm. It costs them more money. So I just let it all sit. And often people will resolve their own questions, and it's usually already documented. Yeah. They're just not reading things. So sometimes leaving it, you know, 24 hours or sometimes longer, and it will self-resolve. So,
yeah. Very nice. So we're all getting to that point of the year. It's, you know, mid-September. Anyone who has a project where the clients are hoping to have Christmas lunch will start to feel a bit stressful. We're all starting to get those emails from Satara and other suppliers, pre-Christmas cutoffs, it's cutting close. It's a pretty stressful part of the year in our industry. What are some of the things that you've put in place in your business so that you don't get to Christmas Day and feel completely shattered and burnt out and maybe never want to go back to interior design ever again? Lynn, what are you doing?
So I just had a holiday, which I didn't think I had time for, but it turned out that it was actually, like, it's a terrible time to take 2 weeks off, but it just gave me a breath so that I can come back with renewed energy and not be narky about the stresses. I think looking after yourself is always key, and I think it's part of what you were saying with, you know, your client communicating how you're handling yourself is read by your client. I think it's good that they see that you're taking a break and they can't contact you. It's good that you can, you know, just sort of show that there's a balance to life and they can't be at you all the time. So just being realistic.
Yeah. And do you do anything around the timing and schedule of your projects so that, like, because so often you'll have, like, we're going to make it in for Christmas, you're going to make it in for Christmas, and it's so clearly never going to make it in for Christmas.
Oh, you've got to be honest.
Just don't say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I always find it quite amusing. I don't know if anyone agrees with this, but most people with this, we must be fabulous for Christmas, they usually hate everyone that comes for Christmas. I'm like, why are we trying to make this so incredible when you actually don't even like the people? Yeah. Anyway, they're showing off for no reason. I just think you've got to be realistic, and I will just tell people very quickly that the cut-off dates for orders are August often with things, and it's just, sorry, it's not realistic. And you will be shut down, your site will be shut down for a couple of months, and it will reopen and go and rent somewhere.
Mm. And life will go on.
Life will be okay.
Yeah.
You'll have next Christmas then.
Yeah. Yeah. Gemma, what about you?
This year, my biggest boundary with Christmas is not hosting Christmas myself, because the last couple of years I have found that lead up to Christmas and then my family arriving when I'm still like working on Christmas Eve and I'm like, ugh. So this Christmas I am fortunate enough not to have any finishing projects pre-Christmas. I have lots of projects starting in January and February that I'm frantically tendering at the moment to start after Christmas. But same thing, I just always remind clients at Christmas, I'm like, you know what, people will love just eating on a tablecloth, you'll be fine. Sometimes they think the world is going to end if said table is not going to come for Christmas Day. And I'm just like, I kind of am like, well, I think it'll be okay. But I mean, and personally, like, I will do a lot of yoga and a lot of like, try and make sure that I take time for myself because I can feel myself now getting quite like snarky or short-tempered more to contractors, not to clients, but.
And I think as well, like, I mean, Lynn, your family's slightly older, but all three of us have young kids, early school. So it's not just work, it's also the chaos of end of year family life. And so I think if you were completely burnt out by work, it just reacts through everything else that's going on. And so I think it's so important that you do look after yourself, kind of thing, because it just, it's not just work, it's everything else.
And I also find January is the best time of year. It's the one time when you're like, I was just away last week as well, and I couldn't relax. It was the I was like, I shouldn't have done this. This is the worst time to go away. Trying to draw on my iPad. So mental note, do not go away in September, October, November, but I feel like...
I'm going to say that.
Well, I don't have staff, so it's probably, yeah. For me, it's not good for my mental health to have my to-do list ticking over.
Sally, what about you?
I also just went away. Obviously, we all take a mid-year
Everyone has been on holiday.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, I went away and the micromanager email only emailed me once.
We found the solution. So that's great. Constantly be away.
Yeah. He sent me a photo of him on the building site with my plan saying, don't be stressed about all the changes I'm making while you're gone, ha ha. And I'm like, cool, okay. Yeah. But I think also for yourself, rather than clients aside, like scheduling your work right from the start of the year. So last year, we had a lot of jobs being built. And I knew that by the end of the year, it was going to get hectic. So we actually didn't take on any, we had basically no design work at the end of last year because I knew I'd be out on site a lot and then it would go crazy. Yeah. So all we were doing was site management at the end of last year. And that actually was great. Yeah. But then last year, this is a great idea. I think we should do it every year. I finished up work at the end of October and went overseas for 8 weeks. And I've never felt so relaxed before Christmas in my whole life.
Yeah, wow.
Not possible every year, but the year before also took a week off in November. And actually, like, you'd still have to do a bit of work while you're away if you've got your own business, but it was quite nice just to, like, remove yourself from the craziness a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm really careful with scheduling from the start of the year. And even if it's really tempting, like, great projects pop up, I just don't take it or just say, can you wait till February?
Yes, and that's a really interesting point because I think so often we get an inquiry or a new client come on and we're like, this project is amazing, like I just have to do it kind of thing. Mm. And then what ends up happening, you get another one and another one and before you know it, you're in this cycle of just constant stress and overwork.
And saying yes to everything.
Yeah. How do you guys schedule out your projects so that there is at least some... It's constant. It's not up and down.
I use a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll have every month and then I'll say which is it, stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, stage five.
Yeah.
But the problem that I'll have is that I think I'm being really organised and I am, and then something will turn to shit and not my fault.
No.
Like a project will end up coming out of DA that I didn't think was going to come out of DA, or all of a sudden the project manager is like, we're going to build this in 12 months. And I'm like, I thought it was 18 months. Like, and it, like at the moment I'm massively under pressure because one house is just completely kicked off not when it was not supposed to. I thought all the joinery would come in next side of Christmas, but nope, they're doing it now.
Yeah.
So as much as the spreadsheet is great, like it was going really well for me until the last 6 weeks, and it's now just, I'm just got to just get to the end.
And has that changed how you respond to new inquiries?
Yes, I will defer, like even if it's a really good job, I've just come to the realisation that there's always really good jobs and you can't do them all, and if you take one on which doesn't light you up, it doesn't keep enough bandwidth for one that does, and if they want to wait, they'll wait. So I'll just say, I'm not taking on any now until February. Do you want to wait? Yes. Great, I'll pop you on the list. I'll touch base in January.
Yeah. Lynn, how do you manage it all?
Look, I have spreadsheets as well, but it's it doesn't really mean very much, to be completely honest. Like, it gives you a sense of you've got everything under control, but then it's not under control.
Yeah.
And, you know, with staff and, you know, all the outgoings of running a business, I say yes to majority of projects. I mean, not if there's red flags being waved, but you're like, okay, well, that'll pay someone's salary or that will pay for computer programs or whatever. So I do get myself in a bit of a muddle. There's no perfect solution. I'm not going to lie. I try to be super organised.
Yeah.
But I also believe you've got to take what comes along.
Yeah.
If it's obviously, I have a criteria list of what I will take, but you've just got to grab what's going to pay the bills sometimes.
Yeah.
And then, like you're saying, you know, you have everything planned out, and an example at the moment, I'm doing a penthouse at the moment, and we've done all the construction drawings, a couple of iterations, demolition, we've discovered all these things that we didn't realise were there, so we're now redrawing things we didn't think we'd be drawing, it's taking hours, so all of a sudden the whole schedule is out the window and we're struggling. So it's stressful.
It's also clients not responding to feedback when they're supposed to.
Yeah,
that's the classic one when they're like, oh, and sorry, I was away. And trades, or yeah. I've got a sick child, and so that's I'm it. Like, so the knock on, I try to, and I can facilitate now, no more work, nothing, no, not doing it. No.
Well, yeah, we have a scenario at the moment where jobs that we designed maybe 2 years ago, where all the construction documentation was finished, then got put on hold, and literally four of them have just popped up again. And are like, oh, now we want to change all of this. Oh, and we need you to requote all the PC items, and like, I need it next week. And a client who we did all the concept drawings for was getting back to us within a week with their feedback for the documentation, and that was 4 months ago. And now they've come back when all the other people have also come back. But it just goes up and down.
Yeah. So really what you're all saying...
There's no way to do it.
There's no way to do it. The spreadsheets are... just rip them up.
Yeah.
I do put a clause in my... when I send out a fee proposal, I'll say all feedback within 5 days, otherwise you will... And so if they come back and hit me, I'll say, you did not respond to me in 5 days, you're now bottom of the pile, I'll come back to you.
Do you actually say it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Because I think
maybe I'm too mean.
I'm like, that's impressive. I'm too scared to say.
Because I think
it's only me. So I'm like, it's only me. Yeah. So yeah, you have to wait. Sorry.
And I think this is a really interesting point. So Lynn, you touched on it before. You actually read through your terms and conditions with your new clients.
Yeah.
It's easy to have these kind of ideas of how we're going to do things and run the project, but then I think so often we become yes people and we don't stick to what we're setting up. So I think sometimes you kind of have to put on your big girl boots or your big boy boots and go, okay, nah, we're a business owner, I've got to do this.
But of course, like, I read those bullet points out, but does my client...
Are they listening?
Some might, some are scared, most of them aren't.
Then you have project managers which will come at you at a different angle.
Yes.
Which I have now, which is a whole nother kettle of, like, they're just going to come in hard on what they want, and they won't miss, it's their terms, not my terms, and I'm like, okay, sure, you can pay me in 6 months, it's fine.
No.
We'll have it later.
Oh dear, oh well, okay. So one of the things that I think is wonderful about all three of you is your genuine desire to help other designers. Gemma, through your passion to help educate designers about joinery and stone. Sally, through giving new grads their first job. And Lynn, through mentoring junior and not so junior designers. It's really obvious what everyone else gets from that, but I would love to know what you get out of helping other designers. Gemma.
I don't really know how I ended up. It wasn't really on purpose per se. But I do get a lot of satisfaction from it. I love hearing when people have purchased one of my guides or asked me a question and I can answer it like that. I'm like, wow, I do know something. I guess as well, I just always go back to when I graduated from uni, the nervous energy that I had and going, I went straight to London, worked in an architectural practice and basically knew nothing, even though I'd been at uni for 5 years and thought that I knew everything. And it was just really, it took me down a couple of pegs quickly. And from then I was like, I'm just going to make sure that I always explain to people, the people that were fostered relationships, you know, were really nice. I did have one Swiss German architect who had red penned the crap out of my drawings. And at the time I'd be like, oh God, he never thinks I'm good enough. But now, like in hindsight, he was just preparing me and it was a gift. Yeah. So I feel like if I can give back to people something that I know, joinery being something that I'm just interested in. I studied industrial design first and then went to interiors, and then I just did shop drawings for joiners and stuff, so I kind of have a good understanding of it, and I feel like as a designer that is such a massive part of the project, if not one of the biggest ticket items, and if you don't understand how to articulate what you want or what the client's budget is and meet the budget and you over-specify, it's embarrassing because it's happened to me before. And there's nothing worse than having to re-specify everything again because you've totally over-specced it. So I guess I just kind of started writing a document, realised, wow, there's so many nuances within this topic, and now I'm knee-deep in hinges at the moment. I didn't know there was so much to do with hinges. But it's interesting, like, even for me, knowing that stuff now, I'm, like, so excited to try these new hinges. I'm like, guys, we're doing this hinge. Like, I'm really excited. And they're like, no one ever wants those hinges in Australia. I'm like, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. So I feel like the more that you know and the more that you can articulate, especially to joiners, the less they're going to, like, you know, that's the trade that I find we'll try and put, well, we can't do that. And I'm like, yeah, you can. Yes, you can. Why can't you do it? Like, and I suppose I've always been a little bit disruptive, so I like to ask why a lot. Yeah, and that's kind of how I ended up doing it.
Yeah. That's very cool. Everyone should have one.
I actually want to buy your
cards. I want to read them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
They're very cool. Lynn, what do you get out of it?
Look, I kind of feel that my staff members, all of them that I've had over the years, it's kind of layered with being a mum. I always felt like I just hope that my kids who are now all out in the workforce, that people give them a go. And that they teach them properly so that wherever they step from and to, they're taking real skills with them. I think one of my experiences, I'd got to the point where I'd built my business to the point I'm like, okay, I'm taking on a mid-level and a junior, you know, growing the business and trying different configurations. And it was a big financial outlay for me. And I had selected a lovely young woman who was a mid-level designer and, you know, interviewed very well, had great experience from good companies, yet very quickly I realised that she hadn't been allowed to do anything. So while she was being paid as a mid-level designer and had all of these years' experience, she was actually no use to me at all. So I tried to educate her quickly, but it just didn't work out. It was hemorrhaging me financially. So I'm very conscious that I think people need to be given a go. I think it's really, yes, it's really hard getting a go in this industry. I think there's a lot of new designers being churned out of all these different facilities. So one, give them a chance to get a job, like I hope my children get a chance to get jobs, and nurture them properly and educate them really, really well. And the other part of that for me is making sure that my whole team work with synergy and rhythm so that everyone is growing from each other. And it's a little bit like children again. I think all of my staff members are holding a mirror up to me. You know, they're showing me, I'm learning from them, and hopefully they're learning from me. And it's important. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Sally?
Oh, firstly, exactly what Lynn has just said. When I graduated from uni, I think I must have applied for about 80 jobs. And it was so depressing and just nothing. And then I got a job with this guy in Mossman, and it was just the two of us for 8 years, and he was the scary German man, basically. He was terrifying, but I literally learnt everything I knew from him, and there was only two of us, so I had to do everything, everything. And then I always thought, when I have my own business, I'm going to do that too.
Am I scary?
My two employees are here.
Oh.
I do red
pen. Does she have a big red pen?
Yes. They were laughing when you talked about the red pen. I could see them.
It's got to be in red.
Yeah.
It does have to be an angry red colour.
But I learnt everything I know from that guy, pretty much. and I always said, I will hire, people with no experience. But be nice. And it's just so satisfying. And also, taking them out on building sites and seeing people learn things. It's so satisfying. It's so hard to get a job. And when I graduated, it was pretty much only unis and TAFE. And now there's, God knows how many design schools. I don't know how all these people are going to get jobs.
Yeah.
So, I just giving people a go. And then, but then we also with the other design, other designers. I also love chatting to other designers.
Yeah.
Because you only learn after things go wrong. And when I started my business, I don't think I had anyone to talk to except for my old boss.
Yeah.
Had he retired?
No.
Okay. Competition.
He actually let me stay in the office working with him on my own business, so he wasn't that bad. But it's so horrible when things go wrong, and so to be able to like chat to other people or encourage people to charge what they're worth, answer questions about, well, what do I do here, or different ways to run your business. Like if you can help someone avoid a really awful situation or help someone like out of a sticky situation, I think it just makes you happy that someone's not going to end up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a state.
Yeah. I'm always open for fee discussions. I'm like, nope, too cheap. Nope. Because it's a disservice to the whole industry if someone's coming in under, and also it's not a free service. You don't go to the gym and work out for free. You don't
go to a lawyer, a doctor.
Don't you think, though, when we all get together, we all talk about the business of design rather than design issues?
Absolutely.
We're all fascinated to compare and learn.
Because there's no standard way to do it. And you never know whether how you're doing it is how everyone else is doing it or how you compare.
And I think that's so interesting because I think as a studio owner, design is actually such a small fraction of what we do.
Yeah.
And I think like talking about like how much you charge, there's so many designers that I speak to who are 5, 6, 7 years into their business and they've never managed to get on top of how much to charge. Mm. And they're so burnt out and frustrated, and it's like, it just doesn't have to be like that. So I think we're opening up that conversation around, well, what do you charge and like what's your hourly rate and how do you do it kind of thing is just... As you said, the whole industry improves because of it.
I actually listened to a good podcast. I say that all the time. My husband laughs. I'm always listening to podcasts. It wasn't an interior designer. I think it was a graphic designer. And it really resonated with me because he said, if you're getting more than like 75% of your jobs, so if you're getting 75%, you're too cheap. You need to be hitting like 50. Mm. You want 50% yes, 50% no, because then you'll know that you're right. And so if you want to invoice 200 grand a year, it's an easy one, then you need 10 at 20 or 4 at 50. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Like, even though and so now I just, every single time, every fee proposal, I'll go up five. And then I just keep seeing, and I'm like, they said yes, okay, next one, up five. And I'm like, I'm just going to keep going, like.
Yeah, and you reach the point and you go, okay, that's my normal kind of thing.
And I have other designers in Sydney that I'll say, hey, what would you charge for four bathrooms, this?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, same thing, great, done.
Yeah. Like, and I think that's so important. So like, where's my trio of ladies? Like over here, I think we've talked on the podcast before, having that group of designers who you're not just like friends with, but they actually understand your business and they understand the type of business that you're kind of growing so that you can sense check that number that you're putting out there kind of thing. Because how else are you going to know? Like how else?
I think the other side of it to think about though is not just how you sit in your industry. It's actually what are my costs to run my business first?
Yeah.
What amount of money do I need to make to run a profit?
Mm.
How is that profit? Is that enough profit to grow my business?
Yeah.
So I think you've got to go back to that and then work out your rates.
Yeah.
So. I actually have a really great spreadsheet. I did some business coaching a couple of years ago and this business coach set up this spreadsheet with me to work out I had one before, but this was much more detailed, all your business overheads.
Yeah.
And you plugged in, we actually went through the credit card statement and found all these things that I kind of forgotten about, like little subscriptions like Adobe
get rid of those.
And we plugged it like all in and it gives you your total running costs. And you're like, oh, okay.
It's often a surprise.
Yeah. That's really helpful. It takes, it's like a 2-day exercise, putting it together, but at least you know what your overheads are and then
I don't think a lot
profit.
Of people do.
No.
And they're more worried about how do I compare to other designers, what are your costs?
Yeah. I think that's so, it comes up so often, people will, talking to what we were saying about how there's all of these designers coming into the industry from design schools. A lot of them are coming as a second or third career and they want to start a business because of the freedom they think it'll bring them. You will laugh.
Big mistake.
But I think as we just said, design is such a small part of it. If you are going to start a business, it's a business. Yes, it's a design business, but you have to think of yourself as a CEO, general manager, whatever title you want to give it. Interior designer is simply a hat you wear on some parts of the day. So I think that is such a mindset that you have to get into if you want to run a successful business.
Yeah. That, I think I said that in, in my interview with you, is, you know, do business courses.
Yeah.
Learn about running a business. The designer's already there. Got to understand how to run a business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, there's something else to add to that. We're laughing at saying, oh, you won't have flexibility, but like, there's no point in having your own, there's no point in having a business if it's not profitable. Like, you may as well just go, well, you may as well just go work for someone else. Like, if you're not making money, like, what's the point? Just being brutal. And also, you do want to get to a point where you can go on holidays. Like, you can go off for 2 weeks and do this and do that. Otherwise, like, you've got no life. Like, that's you have to have a life. Like, I personally work to live. I don't live to work. Like, having, you know, not being burnt out. You want to run a business that you actually like.
Yeah.
And that's some, the only way you can do that is actually by making money. Otherwise, you're just going to be resentful.
Yeah.
We got to make a bit of money, but like, that's not what it's all about. But you don't want to be resentful of your business, burnt out, tired, have no life. Like, what's the point?
And then that ruins your boundaries with your clients.
Exactly.
They know.
Because then what ends up happening is you need to take on those clients that you don't really want to take on.
You're desperate.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're like, oh my God, why? Like, why am I sitting here working on six crappy projects that I hate? So yeah, I think knowing your numbers and having that mindset of I am a business owner first.
Yeah,
I happen to do interior design as part of that business.
So I did this at the, with my we're stage one, which I plan very professional. But I have like what projects are paying when, and so I can go down and I'll be like, I'm breaking even. Right, I need to invoice that person. Okay, I'm over. Okay, what do I want to make this month? So it's very clear, like. What money I need to bring in from what jobs. It also helps me stagger the deliverables on each one so I can make sure that I'm hitting, so that I'm invoicing, because I found previously
cash flow,
I was like, fuck, I can't pay myself this month, but I can pay myself next month, just because I'd gone, because I'd come from in-house, and when I had my second child, I went freelance, and so I've been freelance for a while now, but I found that being able to see it and letting people know that every Friday I'm going to be invoicing, like, to the tap, and not in, I'll invoice you half of stage one, you half of stage two, you half of, and so I can see there's money coming in every week. Otherwise, it was
feast or famine.
Yes, not ideal. It's better now. I've got it under control.
Tick.
I think we deviated from the.
That's all right.
Question.
It's all right. That's how they all roll. Okay. So as business owners, we wear many hats. So we've just been talking about, and one of the things that is so important to a successful business is the communities and networks that you have. Having someone to call on the phone when something goes wrong is so important. Maintaining and developing those relationships is time consuming. Coming to events like this, it's great, but it's time consuming. You know, we've all been talking beforehand. We've all had big weeks and would have maybe liked to be at home in our pajamas by now. But we're here. How do you balance developing those relationships in the industry with everything else you have going on? Lynn?
There's no balance in my life, I'm not going to lie. Look, I when I was very conscious that I needed to be networking in my industry early days, I put a lot of energy into turning up to things, and I didn't know anybody, and I would stand in the room and I would walk around pretending to be absorbed in what I was looking at over and over again. And then slowly I found someone else that looked like a shag on a rock, and I went and spoke to them, and slowly you network. And I really, in my earlier days, I've been in business for about 24 years, and in the early days it was very closed. Like, you didn't speak to anybody about fees or contracts, or it was really hard yakka to kind of build all of that stuff. But in the last 10 years, I would say that those walls have been breaking down, and quite prolifically now. But the thing to remember with, it's great, yes, turn up to everything, and it is exhausting, and there's not often a balance. I think what I was working very hard with networking in my industry was thinking it would help with work leads it actually doesn't. So now I've realised I've got to work hard again at networking with potential clients. And I found when my children were at school that was I was unconsciously networking, and it did bring a lot of projects to the table, but they've all left school. And there has, you know, people still come forward from that network, but finding an environment to network with potential clients is really tough. So you actually have to network both places. But my recent holiday, I've realised that's a place to network. I got a new client last week, which was pretty good. So, yes, so, you know, it is an interesting thing that I don't think there is a way of being totally balanced about it. We should all be balanced and healthy, but I think when you run a business, it's just a huge commitment.
Yeah,
and you've got to make it. But I feel very grateful for my industry network, and I've got a number of people I can pick the phone up and ask tricky questions too, and get honest answers. Yeah. So, yeah.
Sally?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I get, I was saying to Gemma, I actually get really exhausted socialising and I don't go to a lot of events, because I live quite far away from the city and everything's in the city. I pick and choose also so you don't get exhausted. So I go to things here and there, but I also don't actually know that many people. Know a lot of people on Instagram. I've probably spoken to a lot of people here on Instagram.
Well,
I don't even know
each other
who you
on
are.
Instagram. Yeah. I've never met you.
I've never met each other. Anyway. But I find I have a really, for me, it's quality over quantity. And the same with my suppliers, my builders. And I don't like spread myself too thin with using like 10 different suppliers for the tiles and 10 different people for this. And it's more like, working like at your personal relationships with your suppliers. Yeah. I mean, when I call up my tile shops, I know all about all their lives, and I'm genuinely interested. So I would say a lot of my suppliers and builders are my friends as well. And when the shit hits the fan, I can often call my joiner, XYZ builders, my tile shops, and ask for advice. Or just
The tile's leaching. I didn't buy it from you, but I need some help.
Yeah, exactly. That has happened to me too. kind of multitasking your socialising into your suppliers and your builders, because you're going to spend all day with these people most of the time.
Gotta like
them. And I have another designer I'm really good friends with, and multiple times a week when we're in the car driving between sites, we'll call each other and have a good chat, and I'll often just check in with my builders and my joiner who I haven't spoken to for a while, which is rare. Genuinely making friends with the people you work with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gemma, you have the added complexity that you live outside
of
Sydney.
Yes. I'm also not very social. I know people would find that hard to believe. I'm an extrovert introvert. I definitely am a person that needs to be home at night time. Like, this is way past my bedtime, I'm going to be honest. I used to do a lot of networking in London because it was free food and free alcohol, and I had no money, so it was great. But since moving here, I don't do too much networking. I'll do a couple of like Christmas parties, but not so much. And then I just keep all my builders and joiners sweet. Like, I'll take them coffees, I'll take them food, I'll buy them, when they've got babies, I'll take them baby presents, I'll keep them as nice as possible. I get loads of work from joiners, builders, property managers, like anything, you know, the ones that you like.
Yeah.
Keep friends
with.
Whoever you fed the best. Like, I don't want to have a bad name from a builder or a joiner. I think the industry's too small, and I want them to think that I'm adaptable and I'm nice and I'm approachable, and I treat them with the same respect that I would expect them to talk to me. And on the odd time that I will have a run-in with one, we'll make a mental note never to use that one again, and I will tell everyone.
I'll do the same thing.
Don't use that builder. He is really aggressive.
Awesome.
Mental note.
We can talk after.
Yeah. Happy to share a blacklist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually,
got a few. Okay, so you've all been in the industry for a long time. Lynn, you just mentioned you've had your business for 24 years. Mm-hmm. Sally, 13. Gemma.
I was thinking about this with someone the other day. I think I've had my business for 10. But 20 years since I graduated.
Yeah.
A long time.
So a while. A while. And we quite often hear about the successes that you've had in your business and all that kind of stuff. I would love to know, what is a lesson that you have learned when something has gone seriously wrong that has made you really think about how you've done it, how you've run your business, like something that's really kind of gone, right, never want that to happen again. Sally. Oh.
Do you want the actual story?
I mean,
yes. Oh, look,
you're among friends.
Oh, I think we've all had shockers.
Yeah.
I had a particular circumstance. It was probably, this before I had my daughter, maybe 8 years ago, where we did marble mosaic floors in bathrooms. Afterwards, they all looked kind of discoloured. The builder then told my client that marble was unsuitable for bathroom floors. He was Italian. I'm like,
shut up.
But yeah, and then anyway, the client then blamed it on me, wanted me to rip out all these bathrooms and pay for it, which would have cost like 150 grand. Anyway, I was having a full-on nervous breakdown, like having panic attacks on the side of the road. It was horrendous. I just didn't want to do it anymore. It turned out that the tiler, and I had a photo because I was taking lots of site photos for Instagram. No, the tiler had used the wrong trowel, the wrong glue. But I mean, there was no real actual lesson of what to do in that circumstance. But I got some really good advice from a few people, and they were like, one saying was, if in 12 months you're not going to be still freaking out about this, there's no reason like to be totally freaking out about it now. Which is great because you have things that make you spiral. And so I often think about that. Am I going to be freaking out about this in 12 months? Probably not. Okay, stay calm. And the other thing is that everything is figure outable.
And it's, you can fix
everything. Yeah, everything has a solution. Really. So you just got to stay calm and call your builders, your tile shop, whoever. Work out what the solutions are. Work out what the worst possible thing that's going to happen is. Is that actually that bad? And then make a plan. But that, yeah, that was particularly awful. But yeah, I think they happen to all of us. So, yeah.
Gemma.
Oh, I've had the same tiles. Yeah. Do you know what? I actually used to freak out the most when I worked in-house because I hate letting people down. So I have had a few bad experiences, but learning experience. I think when I was younger, living in London, I worked in high-end residential, so it was a lot of high pressure and high profile clients, and so I was probably a little bit too reactive to certain situations that went on. I did have a bath that couldn't fit in through I hadn't ordered the bath, somebody else had ordered the bath in the office, and I had been, this project was like the bomb that nobody wanted, and I kind of got handballed it, and I was like, oh God, I don't want this project, but it was a learning curve. Anyway, the bath wouldn't fit in, we had to take the window off, then the builders used opened a box up, down some silk, like handmade carpet that had been like on back order for like 36 months. I was like, oh my God, the insurance claim. And then I got called up on a Sunday morning from the client saying there's water leaking on my paint. And it was like, I'm talking like a $20 million painting, like something ridiculous. And I was like, okay, I'll be there in a second. And I went down, and that was the first time they had a shower because they'd come back to the property, and the waterproofer had only I had photos, so thank God I could prove they hadn't waterproofed past the point. The water had egressed down through the back of a tile, onto the joist, through a light spotlight and onto the painting. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I just had to listen to him and say, I'm so sorry, like, that's an insurance claim. And yeah, I think in that situation, not to be so reactive and just to listen to the client and realise that a lot of the time it'll be an insurance claim on the builder. So hopefully, as long as everything is correctly specified and you know, there'll be some of those things are like that accidents happen. Everyone's human, that's what I always say to people.
Actually, with that too, though, like as you were saying, as long as everything's correctly specified, in my instance with those tiles, the builder said to me, you should have specified what glue to use then if you're saying this is wrong. But that's actually not right because I obviously had to get legal advice. Yeah. And part of the legal advice I got was don't ever instruct a trade on how to install something. So after that, we got notes added to our drawings please, like, install as per supplier's recommendations. Because if you instruct someone on what product to use and that product's not right, then you're stuffed.
Yeah.
But you only learn these things from something going wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lynn, what about you? Look, so many things, and they're
funny now.
No, they're not funny. I'm still traumatised. Is I specified for the first time ever a dark and nearly black grout in a tile. It was very funky at the time. Well, the lesson was that all went pear-shaped because when this whole house had been done, and I went to have a look at it, it looked like some of it was wet and some of it was dry. It was like these multicolours in the grout because the tiler confessed to the chemist that I had to bring out that he just mixed it a bit like toothpaste. He didn't actually measure the quantity of water. So now I make sure in my FF&E the mixing instructions are given on there. So you're talking about not telling them what to use.
Yeah, that was the opposite of what I was talking
about. Yeah, so like there are a couple of things that just come to mind. There's lots of stories, but if that will help anybody, I hope it.
Moving on to something more positive.
Yeah, let's get happy.
I'd love to know, what excites you about our industry at the moment? Gemma.
Colour. Even though I'm wearing black tonight. Yeah. My husband was like, where are you going? I was like, I don't know, I just put it on in a rush. I've got to go. Colour. I'm glad to see people moving away from white and embracing a bit of colour.
Yeah.
Personally.
Love it.
Yes. Like, I feel like when I moved from London to Australia, I first got here and I was like, wow, everything's quite muted compared to England because people,
so people
live in grey, so grey. So they're like, let's put as much colour in the house as possible because everything's grey. But then when I got here, I was like, oh, wow, it's different. Like, it took me a while. And then I feel like now the Australian design market is like, everyone that I speak to, they're like, oh, you live in Australia. Wow, you guys have got such cool stuff. And I just feel like people's playing with, like, even if it's, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do coloured walls, but like when people have like an art piece or like something fun, I'm like, oh my God, this is so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So colour.
It's very scared of colour.
Sorry.
I'm like, what's wrong with white?
No, it's not white. The thing is though, like I was saying this in the car with the girls on the way over, I don't have a problem with white, but you come to a designer for a different, like you go to the doctor for that. I go to that doctor because they're going to give me what I want. I go to, you know, like, okay, sounds really bad. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, that doctor's easy to deal with. They're going to ask me 500 questions, just give me the penicillin. I know what they've got. Yeah. Like, let's go.
People come to me for white.
Yeah, like, people don't come to me. People don't come for me for white, probably. Yeah. But I don't have a problem with it. That's not a bad thing.
You stay in your lane. I'll stay in my lane. White lane.
Like a bit of colour.
Yeah. There's work for everyone.
Yeah, there's work for everybody.
Yeah, totally.
And it's as well with that and saying that it's like dating with clients. You know what I, but you know what I mean? Like there's enough work for everybody. Yes. What one person offers, it's not just about being the cheapest or the most cost effective or the person. It's about like, I'm going to date you for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, we need to like each other and be on the same page, otherwise it's not going to work. No. Like, and that's okay to walk away from people when they don't have the same taste as you, because then you're trying to create something that you it's don't feel invested
work.
In.
It's never going to work. Sally?
Oh, what excites me is what we were saying, is that everyone's being so much more open and friendly now. Like, when I started my business 13 years ago, I don't think I could have asked anyone for advice or there was nothing like this where people would share, like, horror stories or, like, what to do or advice. I think it's really nice that everyone's much more open and friendly and, you know, you can ring people and if anyone ever wants to call me, call me. I just think it's really nice. I think people are being so much more kind and, I think that's important and supportive. Makes me excited.
I'm excited about AI, and I'm very excited that our industry is now recognised as a profession. That's a huge achievement.
It really is.
Yep, that excites me. And I think learning to use, as AI develops, you're learning to use it to improve what we do.
Yeah.
I think there's some people are scared of it. I guess there's that fear of the unknown, but I think as long as we embrace new technology to help us do our job even better.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Do me a schedule right now.
It will.
Put these things in a schedule. Price it up with 40% markup. Thank you.
Okay.
Done. Amazing. Okay, it's now your turn. Who has a question for our panel? Don't be shy. Come on.
Aha. This one.
she going? Oh.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Thank you all so much for doing this tonight. As somebody who is quite new to the industry and just started my own business, I really appreciate it. And my question tonight is for Gemma. So I am totally obsessed with your content. I've got my like joinery Bible thanks to you. But my question tonight is around your marketing content.
Yes.
And what I was wondering is, you have a way of being very unapologetically you in such a beautiful, authentic way. And it makes me feel like there's an immediate sense of trust there. And so I was just wondering, did that come to you from day one? And that confidence to do that from day one? Or did you really have to find that? And how did you find that?
No, I used to be a lot more PC and that's not who I am. So this is who I am.
Yeah.
So that's how I talk. Yeah. That's how I explain. I swear. I'm rude. I'm crass.
Yeah.
And I think that design is sexy, and yet people knew such dry words to describe it. And I'm like, but it is sexy. I want to touch it. I want to rub it. I want to fondle it. I want to hold it. And I felt like that was kind of missing. And so I was like, I'm just going to go in. And my husband was like, you can't say that. And I was like, well, I've just said it. Too late. Yeah. So I feel like it's grown, and I feel like now it's much more easier because I'm not trying to pretend to be someone that I'm not.
Oh, okay. Mm. Yeah, it's beautiful.
So I'm pretty, this is who I am. This is who I am to clients. I do say that in meeting, like this is who I am. It's like dating. I swear I'm pretty abrupt, but we'll have a whole lot of fun doing it. Like, are you in or you're out?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And if it's okay, I just have a follow-up. And then just for all of you, for if you think back to the very beginning of your careers, did you guys ever have a moment, I'm sure we all have had these moments, but in the very beginning of, okay, I'm the imposter and there's no way I'm going to do this. Totally. Did you have that moment? And if so, what did you do to bounce yourself back?
I still have it.
Fake it till you make it.
Definitely fake it till you make it, but I still have it. I will always have it.
I can't look at a magazine and go, oh man, they're way better than me. You can't, and at certain times of the month, but I'll be like, God's sake. you know what I mean? Sometimes then, but I feel like it comes of age and confidence too. And I definitely think since having children, I don't get so caught up in, I just am like, this is my lane. I'm just going to do what I do. I think everybody else is amazing.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you're not an imposter or you have self-doubt, then maybe you're a narcissist. It's okay to feel like that.
I think feeling like that means you're growing, personally. I don't think it's a negative that you have that.
Yeah.
I think it's just owning it. It just means you're trying to get better.
I'll still get it, if I go into a new tile shop or a stone shop or somewhere where someone doesn't know me, I'll be like, oh, look, hey! And then I'm like, oh, I'm being really nervous.
I'm a designer.
I was cleaning up breast milk before I walked in.
Yeah.
I'm an interior designer, I swear.
Who's next?
So again, thank you all. It's really great to have people sharing their knowledge. And I love how you all talk about, not finding the right client, but having a fairly new studio. I'm pretty much taking any client. And yes, there are some that I don't love, and it's probably one today that I've said no to.
Yes.
But I feel bad for saying no because I probably really need that. So I guess when you're starting out, did you take everything that came along?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think you'd, honestly, at the start, you probably do have to some degree.
Yeah.
But as you, as you build up, you you kind of get to a point where you can say no to people.
How long,
ages to
how long do you reckon that takes?
Forever.
8 years. Yeah, a long time. But it's also hard to be confident enough to say no to someone and oh, I need the money, or oh my God, they're going to think I'm an asshole, or they're going to be mean to me, or. But it does makes you feel good about yourself when you say no to someone who's a red flag. And you've probably also just saved yourself $20,000 in psychologist fees.
That's right. It'll cost you.
Yeah.
But you always make that, but saying no means you're leaving the space for the right job. I do believe in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Good advice.
Yeah.
Okay, who's next?
Someone in the corner.
Oh!
Too many.
Excuse me.
I'm curious about what is maximum capacity. How many jobs can you do at a time?
I'm self-employed, so as in I'm only me. Well, I'll probably have 10 on the go, maybe one big house, four mid-size, and then five like in between finishing off something for someone. So probably 10.
Yeah, we probably have about the same, but you say I can have small ones, but sometimes the small ones take up just as much time as the big ones. It's not an exact science, but I've kind of worked out, we do fixed fees, so I know how much fees per year feels like maximum capacity. So once we know we have these jobs and these are the fees coming in, it gets to a certain dollar figure, I usually know if we get over that, we're going to be stretched. So that's kind of how I work it out, but it's maybe not the best way to do it, but it works for me.
Yeah. I've got about 8 to 12, but I have a minimum investment now. So I will turn people down if they don't have the budget for what they want to achieve and they're not prepared to reduce their scope of works. So it works for me.
Follow-up, love it.
I'm also interested just in an investment guide, sort of to educate the client about how much time each facet takes. I mean, I've put a little bit into that because I've found that people are like, oh, that's a bit expensive, I'm not going to pay that.
But do you mean what your fees are or what the build will cost?
Well, what they want done and what the fees are and sort of the allocation of time, the amount of time we're going to spend against each thing.
Yeah.
Which is not an exact science, but do you have an investment guide that you educate them on that?
We don't. Often people say, can you send your fee schedule over? And I don't really have a fee schedule. I have a spreadsheet with per room. So we ask people to send over their plans or what they want to do. And then I kind of have a number per space. And if we have a chat to the people first and we get a feel for the job, and if you think it's going to be super detailed or they want something like really different or they're like a rig red flag and you need to add extra to it, I can work out roughly what the fees will be and let them know over email before we send them a big proposal, because if it's like way over what they think it'll be, then you don't have to kind of drag it out for them. But I mean, that's how I work it out, but everyone's different with how they calculate their fees, so I'm not sure how you guys do it.
I'm a combo of both fixed and hourly. Yeah. But and I guess something that you'll probably do or are doing is timekeeping for every job that you do. Just literally run every hour it takes you to do each stage, and then you'll start to get a pattern of how long, how much does it actually cost me to execute that stage of a similar job, and that gives you information to take to the next one.
Yeah.
But I also do a lot, I've become better at sussing out projects on the phone. I used to run out to everything and do consults or whatever, but I try to sort of say to the client, you know, have you ever thought about what your budget might be for the job? Let's just say they say $1 million, and I say, well, you know, we've got to calculate whatever percentage will be design fees, and then you're going to have X amount left to do it, and I think you can maybe do some of that scope. So you just start to get quite practiced at, you know, we've got this lump and we've got that lump, we take that out of that, and this is what we left, can we do it? And you work it out pretty quickly. So,
I'll do the same. So I'll say email, and usually it's the first point of contact. Yep. Sometimes Instagram, not very often, because I don't get many from there, but if they were to come through, they'll be like, can you please email me? And then I'll size up straight away, how much do you want to spend? And I'm like, there's no trick answer, I'm not trying to trick you. No. I just want to know, because I'm going to tell you, no, that's not possible, or yes, that's possible. And then if they've got like an idea of build price, I'll normally do a rough percentage of the build price in my head so that I can say that's for fees. And same, I tend not to do jobs under a certain price point just because I find I'm getting better at it. The smaller ones take so much time. So I do like a balance, because I find if I have a really big property, I get quite fatigued from that one and I actually want to go to something else. And sometimes I like going to the small ones because I'm like, yeah, it's just a bathroom. I can just, this is so much fun rather than like 17 bathrooms. Yeah. Same house.
Another thing that might be useful, I don't know if you have it now, but I used to find it was so time consuming. Everyone that emailed me would be like, oh, and how does it work? And I'd be typing out first we do this, and then stage one's this, and stage two's this. And I'd literally be typing out the same thing over and over and over again. And eventually, like a long time later, I made a form with like name, address, project budget, a rough idea of your scope, like what's your style, do you already have a builder, like
the questions that I was always going back and forward and back and forward and back and forward. And then we, when people either fill out the contact form on the website or email us, I just literally write straight back and say, here's an initial form to fill out. And also here's a document with some information on how we work. And then why don't you fill this out and send it back to me? And you can immediately see sometimes if their budget does not look anything like their scope, you can quickly write back and say, I don't think you'll be able to achieve that for this, or have a quick chat, or see if like they're not in your area, or you get a better idea than going back and forth for ages. And then you feel like you have to take the job because you've made friends with them on email. And so that I've found that really helpful, which sounds really basic, but it's,
I also send one, so at the first email contact, I'll send a document called How We Work Together, and it will break down all the stages, what I'm going to do, what's going to be deliverable, and in that document it should give them an idea at the work that's entailed and the documentation they're going to receive, and so generally it will weed out some people too. They're probably like, okay, that's probably going to be quite expensive, probably not right for me.
They're not as shocked when they see our fees in either.
No.
They know what you actually have to do.
I didn't realise I was going to get 500 drawings. I thought I was just going to...
Getting a pillow fluffer. that's what they think they're getting.
Thank you.
Angela.
So as a furniture supplier to the trade, we're dealing with designers that have different business models, and we're finding a trend at the moment where a lot of designers are getting their clients to ring up and pay their trade invoice. We build a lot of margin into the product so that you guys can actually make money from the job and have profitable businesses. What's your view on that? Because I don't think it's great for the industry to be passing through trade pricing to the end client, because all they do is then tell their friends, oh, you're getting ripped off or whatever, and it just becomes the norm. So... and we find it happens with a lot of new designers as well. They're unsure on how to maybe feel guilty that they're making money from the furniture or something. So your views on that?
I might need a whole other evening.
I'm very transparent about it with my clients. Right at the very get-go, I tell my clients that I mark up 20%. That's what I do with FF&E items. It's just a fixed 20%. So I say I pass on my trade discounts because I disclose those. And I add 20% to them, and they're often coming in under retail price anyway. And I say to my clients, this is the fee that you're paying for my intellectual property, and it constitutes my profit margin. So I'm very open. But I know a lot of architects, I've been speaking to one recently, and they order everything and get invoices for their clients, but they pass the whole bundle on to their clients, and the clients go to the supplier directly. There's so many different models.
No one does it the same, that's the problem.
No, nobody does it the same. Sometimes I think, should I change it? But look, it's transparent. It seems to be a model that works in my business.
I've got a new wording. We have a client that's like, well, do you pass on your trade discounts? And we're like, no, it's not a trade discount. That's trade pricing. And that's the price to the trade or the builder. The price to the client is this. But it's not a trade discount, and you don't get a trade discount. That's trade pricing. But it's when you start out, you often think, oh, I should be passing it along because then they get a perk from working with me. And you're like, no, the perk is your design skills.
I think it's gimmicky. And I think the people that are asking for that, I've learnt over time, are actually probably not my tribe.
Yeah, because if you're purchasing it, I'm taking it to your house, I'm putting all that stuff as well. I'm like, it's not just you're paying for it, I have to raise the invoice, chase the invoice, chase the delivery, meet the truck, unpack the thing, it's wrong, send it back.
But it's also the knowledge.
There's a lot.
We know about Satara. You know, the fact that we're reading socials, we're reading magazines, we're listening to podcasts. The hours that are never accountable for in a project is our learning, which is constant. And that's what constitutes that markup.
This morning, if you're working with a plumber, you don't ask the plumber to pass on the
No, and you don't ask the dentist for a discount or a... But I think now that we're going to be recognised as a profession, you watch that change. I hope. Might take a while.
This is actually not a question, it's a thank you. You're really very extraordinary women, and I've learned. I'm an architect, and I've been running my business for about 24 years, and I've learned a lot tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also a little ad, we started an AI company, so if you are interested in
that. Here we go. Scheduling.
Next podcast, Beth.
Yeah, I know. We've got like three or four podcasts from here. Gavin. Okay, last question.
FDI is in the house, just saying.
I'm going to run on the theme of thank yous. It's not necessarily a question. On behalf of everyone in this room, Beth, thank you for what you do for the industry. It's refreshing to hear the conversation tonight that it's about caring for the industry, sharing our knowledge, and sharing things that is as closest to all of our hearts personally and in business, and that's our fees and that's money. Yeah. And the fact that we're speaking openly about that tonight is really refreshing. But back to you, Beth. Thank you for caring for the industry and pulling nights like tonight together. Thank you.
Well, on the theme of thank yous, I'd like to thank these three amazing women. I've now got to chat to you twice, and I feel like I could do several more episodes with all of you. So thank you for joining me for this evening and sharing your wisdom and your knowledge and your caring for our industry. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And of course, thank you everyone for joining us this evening. It is truly wonderful to see this room full of industry friends, as I mentioned before. And I think as Gavin touched on, as we've all touched on, the industry is becoming a much warmer, friendlier, just nicer industry to be part of. So I'm looking forward to seeing you all at the next event. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this design dialogue. I hope you have found it full of inspiration and helpful information to take into your design studio. If you like the podcast and want to hear more, consider sharing it or writing a review, as it helps us reach more people, and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to unlock the power of effortless studio management and elevate your design business to new heights, please follow the links in our show notes to see how More Time to Design can help you build a better business. Have a great week, and I will see you for our next design dialogue.